Good morning, everyone. Given that we're now 10 minutes past 10, I thought we'd best get started. Welcome to the Country and Territory Names Study Group, painful acronym, meeting in San Jose, Costa Rica. My name's Paul Schindler. I'm chair of this group, co-chairing with Becky Burr. We've got quite a lot to work through today, and we've already lost 10 minutes. We may run a little bit over time, but if I could start with some administrative announcements, and that is this session is being transcribed. So could everyone please introduce themselves each and every time they speak for the purposes of the record? And as is protocol, again, for the record, could we start by perhaps with Ron coming around the table and everyone introducing themselves?
Ron Sherwood, I am the CCNSO liaison to ALAC, and I am Nick.vi Virgin Islands, CCTLD.
Eduardo Diaz, representative from the NASRALO and president of the Internet Society of Puerto Rico.
Oksana Prikhotchka, Ukraine, URALO Secretariat, working group on IDNs, variant, and applied IDNs.
Peter von Roster from Center.
Martin Boyle from Nominet, the .uk domain name registry.
Faik Farmanov, .az registry.
Evaz Alashev, Minister of Communication and Information Technologies of the Republic of Azerbaijan.
Keith Davidson, .nz.
All right, Boss Miguel, I can support staff.
Becky Burr, NOMCOM appointment to the council.
Ingarda Kasinskaya Budibak from UNESCO Paris.
Ilya Bazlyankov from GNSO representing CORE.
Jeffrey Kayonga from the Rwanda ICT Association.
Sokola Jiu, NOMCOM appointee to the council.
Grigory Sagian, ISOC AM, CCTLD.AM.
Annabeth Lange from the Dr. Now, the Norwegian Registry.
Elise Lindeberg, the Norwegian GAC representative.
Joke Brage, .eu, URIT.
Monica Konings, ICANN Policy Staff, supporting the GNSO.
Christina Nordstrom, CCNSO Secretariat.
Gabriela Schutzbeck, CCNSO Secretariat.
And if we have no one else on the phone, thank you, everyone. Just wanted to start with a very quick recap. So going through, as I do pretty much at every meeting, where we've gotten to and starting very briefly with our purpose and scope, it's important because we have a lot of people who are keen in the activities of this working group, study group, but not necessarily following it very intimately. So I do like to run through that every meeting. And then moving on to the major element of our work for today, which is the survey, the UNESCO work, the finalisation of a topology, which we'll use to go out to stakeholders to try and solicit back information relating to that would help inform the work of this group. And then, if we have time, and if not, we might spill over to the session we have tentatively scheduled for Thursday, what next, so issues and where will the group go after we've finished this element of our work. As you can see, the purpose of this group is broken up into three areas. Our scope is to look at what is currently existing in the policy, policy landscape of ICANN. So what rules, policies, procedures are there with regards to CCTLDs, the new TLD process, pretty much everything else. And to a large extent, that's been covered, and we've done some preliminary work which we'll pick up when we come towards drafting our final report. We're now at the major stage of looking at how country and territory names are represented within ICANN, but also in other fora, trying to take as broad a brush as possible to all the possible representations, simply because as a study group, and this is what I often stress, we have the luxury of being expansive in our deliberation. We're not bound by, we're not limited by sticking to a particular set of rules or what currently is in ICANN, because the more that we research, the better our outcomes will be. And then once we've finished this, we'll map the two against each other. So take the policies, look at all the types of country names that we find, and what happens when we plug those names into the policies that we have. Are there any problems? Are there any inconsistencies? Are there gaps where things can fall through? And also, obviously, at this stage, we're now starting to brief other stakeholders and their representatives, good representation from across the community here, but we will also continue. I intend to sort of release a progress report of where the group's up to the community, not necessarily soliciting comment, but if they choose to provide it, excellent. But just so, again, everyone's aware of what we're doing and where we're up to, because if they're not following the group so very closely, it's quite easy to be confused about our purposes and progress. And then, of course, finally, at the end of the year, the intention is to report to the CCNSO Council. That's just an administrative necessity. It was the council that convened this study group, hence that's the one we report to. And then, of course, the report will be made public for community dissemination as well. Just again, this is probably my favourite slide because I talk about what we don't do, and I bring this one up every meeting. And I'll continue to do so. We're not here to define what is and isn't a CCTLD. We're not here to intervene in the first round of new GTLDs. That comment's becoming increasingly redundant as time goes by. But because our work commenced before ICANN launched the first round, there was some concern early on that we were supposed to intervene. Again, country and territory names have been prohibited from the, or put aside, set aside from the first round of new GTLDs. It was specifically the work of this group to try and deliver something before the second round. Hence, I set the date of roughly December or the last meeting of this year, seeing on how we're going, because best guesstimates in a best world environment, the second round could start early next year. Nobody really expects it would, but we can't be unfinished at that time. We're not judging or assessing previous policy approaches. There will be an element of just assessing what is and just stating it as a statement of fact rather than saying, well, because this is how we treated CCTLDs before, this is how we treated GTLDs, there's a failing, but we'll just assess what is. And it's also outside the scope of this group, very much so, to make any recommendations about additional protections for country and territory names. Because we are talking about a lot of representations doesn't necessarily lead to the assumption that there will be an expansion of protections. That's not within our scope. There may be recommendations that come out of this group that would discuss possible additional work, maybe, and what that would be the scope of sort of the next group, a working group that might come out of this. And of course, we can't develop a definitive recommendation for how country and territory names should be treated. That sort of recommendation can't come out until after further work's been undertaken. Again, that's our work plan and schedule, just a brief timeline of we've developed a policy overview. We're working on a typology and getting that survey out now. We would then move to a discussion of issues. So this is starting to get into step three. We all know of these problems that are out there, or particular examples which don't fit in the rules, and we talked about them in the hallways and at the bar, etc., and how these won't necessarily work given current framework, but we need to start discussing it and putting some substance to that. Then there will probably be, I've called it an issues paper, but it suggested to me that has a specific meaning within ICANN, so it's a progress report, and I'll get that out as soon as possible, and some consultation leading into Prague and far more community consultation there. And then if possible, I'd like to do a second round of survey work, but this will be a case of if time allows, heading towards final consultations at the end of the year. Are you in the Adobe room, or do we have an Adobe room for this session? Nope, good. Then I don't have to worry about not logging onto it. So again, there's agreement by UNESCO to assist us back in September 2011, and getting onto the survey element now very specifically, it's proposed to be at least a sampling of 20 to 25 member states with an intention that all of the questions and what goes into it will be developed by this group. There is some input from UNESCO about the process and how it would work most effectively through that organisation, but really it's up to us as to what we ask them. And then also those that are respondents would be selected with geographic diversity in mind, i.e. we wouldn't be soliciting 15 responses from Europe. Obviously, that would be unsustainable. There are some issues about how the member states are selected, and there are some administrative and sort of logistical issues associated with that. Those that UNESCO and MGADA, please jump in at any stage if I need to be corrected, but those would largely be self-identified, and those that UNESCO knows are efficient and effective and where they've got good linkages. So going out to those that they expect to get a good response from, but keeping in mind the whole geographic diversity issue as well. And once the survey gets started, it's about an 8 to 12 week process. Is that right, MGADA?
Yes, it's approximately the schedule what we are proposing.
Okay, thanks, MGADA. We can barely hear you, so if you do have something to add, could you speak up a little bit, please? Again, further about the survey, this is not just about gathering information, but we're about testing the process. So whatever we come up with, does that make sense to respondents? If we get a whole bunch of confused responses back, which don't necessarily equate with what we expected to receive, then that tells us we're doing something wrong, and we could go back and refine the process after that. What I've done in the draft that I've worked through now is repeatedly ask for respondents for just about every question to provide examples or references or citations of their claims. So whether that's a national statute or because it's a name or an abbreviation or what have you that's used in international fora, etc., we put the onus on them, given their local expertise, given it's based on their country name, to identify where they use it in that way. That helps validate our work as well. The question has been, how do we validate the responses we get back? And the best way we can do that is ask for citations. If there are no references provided, that immediately means we have to undertake more research work, but also brings into question the substance of the responses. Again, just a brief mention there that this is about refinement and possibly getting out a broader secondary survey. And as has been mentioned by some working group study group members previously, although this will be tailored for member states of UNESCO to respond to, it will only take slight adjustment, and given all the contextualization material we've attached to it, it's quite workable for it to go out to other members of the community. So particularly, as I've said, through the ALAC, it could certainly get into sort of NGOs, etc. I don't want to limit... UNESCO has been chosen because they've offered and because there's a certain level of expertise and gravitas that comes from having them participate. But I'm conscious of not limiting it just to sovereign states. Their responses are very valid and will be very important as part of this process, but if I can get the survey out more broadly, it will also be interesting to see what we can get out from those that are inclined to fill it in. Of course, we can look at everything we receive subjectively and make an assessment on what we receive when it comes in. The following slide is a little bit hard to read, but just very briefly, this is the administrative stuff that UNESCO helped us with. This is exactly how it would work, the mechanisms it needs to go through. I won't cover it in too much detail, but basically UNESCO having a responsibility for developing and circulating an official letter of invitation, putting it in their newsletter so that other countries can self-identify and institutions that have relevant expertise can self-identify. We won't say no to anyone. If through the newsletter we get a greater number of respondents back than the 20-25 originally foreseen, that's fine. That's a great outcome. And then, of course, a survey will be designed based upon the questionnaire we come up with. In some cases, there will be a formal process of a nomination of the institution that will be responsible for doing it, and then they'll complete the survey. There's various mechanisms, obviously, within countries that they have to go through. For instance, in Australia, there is an organisation, it looks after the Council for Geographic Names of Australasia, for instance. It has nothing to do directly with CGNA. It's got nothing to do with UNESCO directly, but one part of government will find them. That'll take a bit of time. Now, this is the main bit of work. I'll just pause there if anyone had any comments or questions about where I've covered off. That's again, all coverage of what I've discussed previously. But the next step, my aim would be to get into very much the detail of the survey. Were there any comments or questions now? Good. Now, the topology, obviously, this dates back to a straw man that Bart first developed, which was there was some a basis, of course, in ISO 3166-1. There was reference to UNGGN titles and headings, etc., and it's since been refined five or six times to try to narrow it down based on everyone's comments. It's a delicate balancing exercise because we want to be precise with our questions, but the more precise and specific and prescriptive you are, the narrower a field of responses you get. So you try to be as broad as possible without being vague, and that's the delicate line that we've tried to work through in the drafting of this. I'll start with the first question. There are 10, and I really would like to get through them all. So the first one was the easy one to an extent, ISO 3166-1 Alpha 2 codes. It is the basis currently upon which CCTLDs get their codes. It is commonly used within this community and others. And yes, we essentially know the answer for everyone who will fill in this survey already, but it's in Australia we call it a Dorothy Dixer. It's the easy question that warms everybody up and just starts the process. So that's question one. And again, hands up or comments or interjections, please, at any stage if there's any concern. Otherwise, I'll keep moving. Then we get into Alpha 3 codes. Now, this is an area where some people have expressed some concern. Again, there is no particular desire for expansionism of protections here. I've explained in greater detail in the document that I circulated that, yes, everybody knows .com is a well-established, incredibly well-known GTLD, and it is also a three-letter country code. And that fact, and the fact that they coexist harmoniously and have done for however many years it is something that's worthwhile of us probably noting in our final report. It is just what it is. There is, of course, reference. I sort of mistakenly said, oh, look, it doesn't actually have an official status in ICANN. Well, I did forget about the African Guidebook where the first point, is it a country or territory, refers to ISO 3166-1 Alpha 3 code. So, yes, it is used in ICANN. And, again, this is codes like AUS, NZL, or DEU, and they're commonly used in a range of activities, though I note, yes, including airports, and not necessarily used consistently. Again, this is a fairly straightforward question, and the fact that respondents, if a respondent from Comoros happens to submit that .com is their three-letter code or something that might clash with another proposed new GTLD, that is not a problem. That is just a statement of fact and something that we would factor into our deliberations. Third one might need a little bit of work. This is other common abbreviations. This was stemmed from a little bit of research I did into other lists. So I thank YAP for pointing out that there are web-based resources which compare and contrast various official lists. This might be anything from ISO to the International Olympic Committee, the IOC and FIFA, etc. You will, for instance, see runners in London from Barbados under the code BAR, not BRB, as it is in ISO list. So the intention of this question was just to capture some of those. I could see somebody applying for .bar, actually. I couldn't see them applying for .brb, but irrespective of that, again, if there is confusion there, if there is some sort of confluence of uses, that is fine. And that is what I'm trying to ascertain from this one. Again, this is the first example where we start talking about please provide us with examples and cite your references. Which list are you referring to? Where is this being used? We did get a response from Heather Forrest yesterday, which I'm only starting to digest, but she talked about are we talking about just abbreviations or acronyms? Well, yes, possibly. And would we narrow it down to a list of standardised codes, three-letter standardised codes, so specifically you must refer to that list? I'm inclined to try to leave it broad. This is one where I'm trying to be a little bit vague on purpose to see what comes back, specifically because we have the protection of please provide your examples and references. So somebody can't come up with, I don't want somebody to tell me that sometimes you may use AUST, AUST for Australia, unless there's a commonly used context and a reference which they can tell me that that's where it's used. So I am inclined, unless others feel strongly otherwise, this will capture other lists of three-letter codes, but in case we haven't thought of something, are there other abbreviations, and I may change it to abbreviations and acronyms, that we haven't picked up? So that's the purpose of that one. Are there any comments on the phone at the moment? Good, thank you. I'm sorry, I think I just ignored Keith.
Keith Davidson, WNZ. While we're at this point, and I noticed the wording in the paper you circulated, Paul, about the ISO 31661 Alpha 3 codes have no formal status in the ICANN process. And I'm just not quite sure that that's absolutely accurate.
Can I just correct myself about that?
Yeah, but actually, I understand YARP's on the line, and I'd sort of seek his clarification in greater detail, if he is, that IANA has a specific three-letter country code
Yap, are you actually on the line?
Yes, I'm back on the line. I mean, the line is kind of flaky, so it goes up and down. I didn't hear the question.
Oh, Pete, an observation I made earlier that
I'm sorry, this is fading again. I don't hear anything.
I'm sorry, yeah.
The line is fading. I didn't hear what you were saying.
Can you... iterations, and as I said, already identified it. Yes, it does have status in the applicant guidebook, for instance. And then beyond that, yes, you could be quite right. I'm just not certain of the specificities there, but certainly within IANA processes as well. So I will change the contextualisation there to refer to those.
I think it goes a little bit deeper than that, and I'm looking at, for example, RFC 4350, which is from the New Zealand government, which is sort of requesting IETF to reserve NZL as being specifically a three-letter country code for delegation in the IANA database. Now, whether or not, I don't know the status of that anymore, but notwithstanding, there is some moves by some governments to ratify the IANA database listing of a three-letter country code that goes back historically, more than 5 years, and I know YARP has some information about XML tagging of three-letter country codes in the IANA database too. So I think it's more than just the applicant guidebook.
Oh yeah, of course, acknowledged, and we'll expand upon that in subsequent iterations, making reference that the more references we provide of examples, the more it actually validates the reason for us asking, because it is used. But
we'll send the question to YARP so everybody can see it.
Thank you.
You respond on the email list.
Looks like the line is destroyed again. So.
Did you manage to catch any of what was just said, or the question?
No, just the last few sentences.
I identified that there wasn't an official status of Alpha 3 codes, ISO Alpha 3 codes within ICANN processes. And my concern is, for instance, in the applicant guidebook, and Keith clarified that IANA also has specified that interrelationship with that element of the ISO list and IANA.
You better ask IANA directly, but as far as I know, it's only via the two-letter code that there is an official relationship.
take that as noted and as a subject for further explanation and extrapolation later in our process. Thank you. This is where we start asking for either the official or the formal long form names of countries. Now, there, because to a lot of states it does mean something. So I'm acknowledging that to some it does not. But it, in as few words as possible, conveys as much meaning and the sense and the purpose of the question. I'd remove the term conventional long form name, because in many lists that means your name in English. The official long form name of Poland, apologies for the accent, Rzeczpospolita Polska or something like that. Almost, I know. But to say that it's Poland or whatever, it would be the representation in English, so that's why that has been removed. And other examples are put in for the sake of clarity. It may be that the term formal name or principal name or name used for administrative purposes, which is very specific and does have meaning to governments, are all included in there. The difficulty is with being a little more specific about how we ask for this. Is this in multiple, and the reference to official languages was removed because that is problematic and a little limiting. And I'd currently put in the term designated languages simply because that's consistent with the terminology that was used by the IDN CCPDP Working Group 1. That's the term they came up with, and they had a definition of designated languages. In the response received from Heather Forrest overnight, she questioned whether that would cause as much confusion or as anything else, or possibly place a limitation on the number of responses we received. So there are a few options there, and I still don't quite have the answer because I'm still thinking about it myself. I mean, Bart has talked about languages used for administrative purposes, because, again, that's got meaning, but we've talked about that previously, that can also confuse.
If you look at, say, the term designated languages in the IDN CCPDP has been included to get away from official languages. But if you really look into it, there is a definition in the PDP and even in the fast track of what is an official language. And that definition, I would advise to include the definition here instead of, say, what we understand on the designated languages.
Official
is
or designated? You said official languages. You mean that the definition of designated languages?
It's the same definition. The only thing is we got rid of the term official languages because in countries like Sweden, it creates a lot of confusion. And if you start to using a term which is very vague but then include the definition, what you really mean, then people start looking at the definition instead of having this idea of what is an official language.
And at this point, I'd prefer that the more detailed notes that I sent out actually had a footnote that provides a link, and of course that means that somebody has to go dig it up, so I can certainly make it more prominent than that. But it is a link to pages 5 and 6 of the November 2010 report of that working group where the definition is contained.
One of the nice things of that definition, in fact, you could refer it back to the UNGEGN, because this definition has been developed by the UNGEGN, so the United Nations of Geographic Experts, etc., on geographic names.
Another one of those unwieldy acronyms. Yes.
So it's not a definition out of the blue, and it's used in OECD material as well.
And that's probably why I think it's currently the best language, and particularly if we can define what we mean, it might be the best language to use. The only reasonable alternative is to omit reference to languages altogether and then you just see what you get back. But that's us going from being broad to being vague. So to get meaningful responses, I think this is probably the best that we have. That's still an open issue for discussion. We need to decide it very soon. But at this stage, what I would welcome is... But...
There is another reason for including it, especially, say, the official languages or, say, the designated languages, because that's one of the fundamental criteria in one of the policy processes. So it's a bit goal-seeking definition. But otherwise, if you include everything, then we have to sort out what is your designated language or official language.
Yes.
So that's why it's very important to make that distinction.
Absolutely. So currently at this stage, moving forward, very specific if somebody has some, because otherwise that would be the language for the reasons we've just discussed. That's the language, the wording that we leave in for the reasons that we've discussed. And unless somebody comes up with a solid proposal for another one rather than, don't know if this works, that would probably be the best way to move this forward. Strachan. Again, using the conventional name. And this is, I don't think there's anything further to discuss about that one. It's exactly the same as question four, except short form rather than long. Attempt to start broaden the responses that we receive. It would certainly be possible for respondents to limit themselves to the characters and languages and scripts with which they are familiar, and particularly if they are bureaucrats, to which are their official or administrative languages. This starts conveying the message that the internet is, of course, stating the bleeding obvious, multinational and borderless, and that respondents need to start thinking about representations of their names in non-official languages, languages that may not be official for them. And of course, this is just a starting point, the easiest one to go to, and again, this is something that we could gather the response from a document I already have, that lists the official languages of the UN and then provides the country names in those languages. That is what we would ask respondents to provide here. It is as specified there, so it's Arabic and it is Chinese, Mandarin specifically, English, French, Russian and Spanish. One that was raised was, would respondents with no familiarity, particularly with, for instance, Cyrillic or Arabic or what have you, have difficulties with responding to this? I mean, they would presumably be experts in their field anyway, but I have included a reference in the extended explanation which provides a link, which I'll expand out, to a UNGEGN list, which is basically the answer list anyway, but provides examples of languages in those scripts. So if they are stuck, there is a reference that they can go to. And it is supplemented by question seven, which then becomes a little bit broader, and we start thinking about other languages, and subsequent questions do this too. And this might need to be changed to designated languages or what have you, providing the short and long form names of the other participants in the survey in your designated language. So although a number of examples already would have been captured, this means that if we end up with a list of the 20 and 25 respondents, we're covering 15 or 16 languages, depending on how it goes. And again, diversity with that regard is probably a good idea. They would, in their own language, identify how they refer to the other countries. So, I would probably, I should have included a reference and will, that again, citation or references to where they get this information from would be a good idea. But this is looking at it from the other way, not how you describe yourself, but how you would describe the others that are participating. And because it's not a confidential process, Garda, this is where I'm going to possibly put my foot in my mouth. We discussed this previously. It was a suggestion that arose from you. I take it that there's no difficulties with providing the respondents of a survey, the full list of who's responding to a survey, to the UNESCO members when it goes out. the administrative exercise of do you step on any toes if you mention everyone that's proposed to respond to a particular survey to everyone else that's participating. If there is a problem there, then of course this question becomes redundant, but it was something that Mgada suggested as a way of limiting the scope. You can, please don't tell us the names of all the other countries of the world in other languages. It's providing some scope, at least the 20 to 25 that respond to this survey. Particularly want to speak to Bart because it's an example that's dear to your heart, but examples of other commonly used or local names. Holland. Wouldn't be kept anywhere else. And again, because the questions are becoming increasingly open-ended and may draw a bigger field of responses, this is where it's important for the identification of references and citations and where and how this name is used.
Probably important is that Holland, say in Dutch, is a commonly used name for the Netherlands. Include that as an example. Otherwise, I know in some countries they refer to the Netherlands as Holland.
Yeah. So just for the sake of clarity.
Yeah.
This line now gets to the very, very specific topic of country and territory names in either minority or indigenous languages. For a wide range of obvious cultural reasons, it's prudent for us to try to capture as much as possible indigenous languages, some of which, in the case of New Zealand, for instance, would have official language status. New Zealand language, I suspect. But it is... It is an official language, so that would be captured in an earlier answer. They may not be recognised. I'm using official language again here, but designated language. That may not necessarily capture indigenous languages in other countries. So we're specifically asking for it here. And again, this is where citations and references are incredibly important. Although there was a question about, I think this came from Avery at some stage, about the relevance of including significant migrant populations and how they may refer to it. In all the previous examples, unless both Australia and Greece are responding to the survey, you would not pick up the Greek reference to Australia or the way in a Greek language it would be pronounced. But, of course, we have a significant migrant population, for example, and many others, would be captured as a significant part of the population. This may not draw many responses. Countries may choose not to respond with a very expansive list, but some countries have one or two significant migrant populations that make up a significant part of the community, and that's what we would attempt to catch here. I'm disinclined to remove it because this is simply part of the expansive nature of the survey. Again, with the citations and references provided, that would quite simply be, well, here's a breakdown, CIA World Factbook or local resource of here's what our population breakdown is, and 12% of our community is this such and such a migrant population and identifies as such, and here's how they use our country name. So mainly it's two things here, as I said, minority languages, local minority languages, migrant languages, and those of indigenous communities.
Or if there is a transcript record. Okay, there is. Good. For the transcript record, Cheryl Langdon Orr. I'm just a little bit nervous here that we need to perhaps have the word written here because there are oral Indigenous representations and they'll come up in your fact books and your references, and we want to make it really clear that we're not interested in those. So just maybe a little wordsmithing there to be sure we're talking about written. And that saves 487 representations coming from the indigenous language groups in Australia, which we really don't want to know about in this survey.
Mm.
Thank you, Cheryl. Question 10 was the last one, which I have described as horribly broad. This is the catch-all question. I'm more comfortable including it at the end because we have included many other examples of language representations, and there may have been, and I don't know how, something that might have fallen through the cracks that is not captured somehow under any of the other headings. Therefore, the respondents to this survey, as they've worked through it, have started from the very simple, very clearly defined ISO lists and then started getting more broad and then started thinking about other countries and in other languages. And by this stage, hopefully, they're thinking quite expansively about and it may trigger something in their mind to realise, oh, well, yes, I've actually, there is this other representation that hasn't been captured. And again, in this case, again, wordsmithing from Heather quite correctly pointed out, let's remove in this case the if possible provide explanation. Please provide explanation in this one particularly. Citations of where these other names have been used, because this is probably possibly the most obscure area, and we would need references for our work here as well. In 10, we'll be testing their patience with this many anyway. So unless there were significant suggestions that would need to be added in, I would propose to leave it at about that number, but please treat this very much as a final call, because we are looking at UNESCO commencing their work imminently, so we need the finalisation of this. I will send something along those lines to the list either later today or tomorrow saying, this is where we've gotten to, here are the few refinements that we discussed. Are there any final concerns? So very much, this is pretty much it. We will then continue discussions with UNESCO, and I know Mgada's on the phone, and again, she can interject if she can hear us, the document that I sent around that had a lot of the explanatory notes, the proposal is that those explanatory notes go out as part of the survey, because it's taken that to explain it to all of ourselves. It would very much need to be included to make sense to the respondents. There may be a little bit of working with regards to format and something that's standardised as part of UNESCO, but to date they've shown nothing but flexibility in terms of what they can accommodate, and it's largely been up to what we can come up with. So that's where that one's up to now.
Martin Boyle from .uk. Just a little question about the UNESCO process for putting out the survey. The timescale is, according to your first slide, quite tight. UNESCO are limiting the numbers that they're going to be sending it out to. Have they given you any reasonably clear idea of how they expect the responses to come back? Will they get them back from everybody they go out to, or is it just a sort of couple of percent or whatever? Mm. It'd be just nice to have that in our heads so that we have set our expectations correctly.
Do you want to speak to that, if you heard Martin's question in the first instance, before I have a go? Some difficulties. My best recollection is we've had a number of discussions about this. From UNESCO's perspective, they suggested that 20 to 25 was very manageable, and that part of that process means that they can follow up and chase up with respondents very effectively and try to deliver, and you can't guarantee 100% return rate, but they were very confident that this is a number that they can keep their finger on and chase and get a good response rate. If there is very preliminarily air silence, no response, not even an acknowledgement, then obviously we could perhaps move to accept someone else. The next,
And this would be good because, I mean, 20 to 25 is a logical first step because it would get us some responses and we can work out how far off or far out we are. And the time frame, again, was something that was proposed by UNESCO and that they can, they're quite confident they can do this in 8 to 12 weeks. Not our time frames, that was theirs. Also, the going out to their member newsletter starts leading to the self-identification. No one's excluded. If somebody wishes to participate in the survey, they can. Now, as I've mentioned before, in an ideal world, these responses come back in good time. We may not have them analysed, but we've got them around the time of Prague. It would be great if it's refined and then sent out as a general notice again, or a newsletter or to all member states, and this is where your response rate becomes poor, because it could not be followed up. You need to spend 6 months chasing all member states for responses to this sort of thing. But as a secondary step, that would just add to the comprehensive nature of our work. So that would be a great second round if we get to it. But there is that opportunity for self-identification this round. So the details of the selection process and who it goes out to will be something that we'll have further discussions with UNESCO about, like in the next week or two, and we'll brief the group about that as it's resolved. Largely an administrative decision, but an important one, and we want to convey how that decision is taken to everyone.
We don't have any verification on this one.
We did, yes. I'm just referring to my notes so I make sure I get the language correct here. But there were a couple of categories that had been omitted following a few discussions and comments from those within the group. Historical is difficult. It's politically sensitive. It's timeline dependent. We would need, do we ask for historical names within the last 100 years or the last 1,000 years, or do we go back further than that? And as we dig further into that, we dig ourselves into a deeper hole of detail and difficulty, and it becomes more problematic and possibly questionable for the purposes of this survey. We are looking at what is now and how that works now. There has been a proposal, and as such, that's why it was taken out of this survey, because it becomes really hard. We would spend a whole day trying to work out how we ask that question carefully and articulately and may still hit upon considerable political sensitivities. I could think of half a dozen examples off the top of my head, given the survey process. So what I think is that while it wouldn't be a question in the survey, collectively, generally speaking, the matter of historical names would be acknowledged in our report. We talk about it in general terms, that there is, of course, always, and countries may well choose to assert their rights with regard to historical names, but not provide that as a question. No, not a list, because that becomes very difficult. So,
it means other.
Other?
Definition. Not historical name, but other definition of country and territory name.
Well, that could be the broader heading it comes under. There will also be, there'll be historical. And there
or a remark. Yes?
Yes. And also future names.
Number 11 catch-all, especially if we dig, sheriff transcript record, I was just thinking, especially if we end up ditching number 7, a catch-all that is either a new 10 or 11 for remarks and other inclusive of, could be a nice, you know, it's an addition. Yeah, well, the reference might be the issue. Yeah, you're right,
though. Happy to agree to that just for the purposes of being comprehensive, but I would necessarily be, I would be inclined to be, again, in that case, vague, because whoever wants to nominate whatever can there. But again, beyond that, so yes, it's fine to add that as other remarks or comments, observations. But again, for the purposes of final report at the end, and yes, if we get something back there, we can cover historical names and then future names. We don't have a crystal ball, but there's a few countries process of being formed now. So that's something that, although an obvious statement, it's worth saying that current policies will necessarily be limited by what is now the application of it, and future names just need to be observed as something that happens. as I said, that survey and a redraft hasn't quite happened because, well, it's kind of pointless until that version was finalised. But once this is all locked in, the language will be gone through to see whether it needs to be less bureaucratic or whether the definitions and the language within it are perfectly acceptable for all stakeholders. And then I would propose that as part of a progress update, progress report on where this group is at, we let everyone know, and I'll be letting governments know later this week at the GAC, because this is a matter for just at least reference, that this is happening through UNESCO and everybody's aware of that, and then also the survey will be made available. This is just part of self-identified respondents that I don't mind if we get the insensitive garbage, but if somebody for some reason decides to fill it in and they have no knowledge, no expertise, no authoritative status to respond, there's no reason why we wouldn't welcome it. We would identify it as such as soon as it comes in, but it's just important that other elements of this community, particularly for those where they feel the expertise may lie in a non-government organisation unlikely, but if there's some channel through the contacts that are here within ICANN, thinking about the ALAC here, Cheryl.
Oh, thank
you, Mike. Yeah. If there are people with suitable expertise there, they see the survey and don't feel excluded, that they don't have the right to send it on to colleagues and or respond themselves. So that would be attached to a progress report, which would go out at about the same time, just letting everyone know where we're at. We could.
Yes, Ron Sherwood. Is there attached to any of these documents a definition of country and territory? Is Borneo a country? Is England a country?
I'll first say that obviously for the purposes of a survey going out through UNESCO, you have your definition of what those respondents are going to think a country and territory is in the first instance. But to expand upon that.
I think that's why the importance of including ISO 3166 and the reference, because that's the definition for country and territories. That's again one of those distinguishing factors. Only, say, in the ICANN context, only if you're on that list, it matters. If you're not on that list, it doesn't matter.
That's right. So you're citing the
1501. No, you're citing ISO 3166.
Absolutely.
And it's because, say, that's why we use the term country and territories. Say, there is an official list of what is a country, and that is the UN list. This is then the basis for the ISO 3166 with some additions for special purposes. And in this environment, ISO 3166 is in fact the starting point.
The point that Bart makes, because from there we step off into completely different territory. We start getting much broader. And the important thing there is, and that's again why we will know all the way throughout this process, that this is a study group. We're trying to find as many meaningful responses as possible. Please provide us with whatever you think is appropriate, and that will be part of our work. We're not doing our job properly if we don't seek as much input as possible, and to then convey back to the community that this is not an attempt to expand the definition of country and territory names. We can't do that. That is not within our scope. Again, it's just helping us identify what is and what may be. What I'm specifically thinking of is the second round of new GTLDs, income, all these applications, early warning, GAC governments put up their hands and say, well, that actually means something to us. Trying to foresee examples of where this might happen, because we'll know the problem when we get to it. If we can foresee some of them now, then we've done our work as a study group.
That's you. My question is, I still am not clear on the process of selection of 20 to 25 countries, you said, from UNESCO.
That's
it going to be a random selection, or is it already an idea of what countries are going to be in the list?
Other than from a definitive commitment from UNESCO that there will be geographic diversity, and that's important because if you're simply to look at those countries that UNESCO knows could are administratively expedient with this and could answer it quickly, that would probably narrow your geographic diversity very quickly. So it will be broken down. Definitely not getting into a discussion about regions here now, but looking at Ron. But it will be broken down, and we still have to have further discussions with them, and it won't go out, and I mentioned this earlier, that they would provide final advice as to the best way to do this. And then that would be relayed to this group, because aside from the diversity, there hasn't been any, you know, clarity there.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the desire for language diversity is important as well, and it would be fantastic if you get 25 countries with 25 languages and multiples of that. But other than those specifics, I don't have an answer yet, so we'll circulate it in terms of how they are selected.
So the selection process is exclusively the right to UNESCO, or
they're going to provide us advice,
okay,
about, from an administrative perspective, they've done this before, they send surveys out all the time, and this is how they would propose to select 25.
Okay.
And yes, then very much for our final input.
Thanks.
It's not an exclusive choice anyway.
No.
So even if they choose 25 countries and we find that somebody else should be approached, we can do that, or do it on a voluntary basis as well?
Yes.
Yes.
And if there are representatives at this table or in the broader ICANN community who feel that it is in their best interest or their government's best interest, and they have links back there is absolutely nothing stopping every GAC member, for instance, from sending it back to, aside from effort and inclination, to send it back to Capital and have it circulated that way, making it aware that it is. And again, this is why we use UNESCO as well, because it has that certain imprimatur, but it's not meant to be a limiting factor by any means. So I can certainly see that certain people within our community may be disappointed if their country is not represented, and they can help facilitate that by all means. But
and what is important to keep in the back of your mind, especially for this first round, it is a test. It is a test both of the typology itself or of the categories we've identified, but also of the process.
Yeah.
So you want to have... Yeah, you want to be able to manage that process if you do some testing. Otherwise, you just do a dry run, and it's very difficult to get back to countries if they've done it for one.
And then, of course, an iterative process for the finalisation of our work. Put out a draft report, send it out, start getting some comments on that with the aim of finalisation towards the end of the year. And we're done. Thank you, everyone. Any comments, et cetera, please? Oh, Leslie has one.
Sorry. I'm not meant to be in this meeting, but I kind of gate crashed. So there's a request for some updates from this working group.
Yes.
On some of the CTNSO joint meetings with other parts of the community.
Yes.
Just to encourage you and remind you about that.
Yes,
you.
Indeed. I have identified. I identified GAC at the very level. At least, but stop doing
thank
that.
You.
But yes, then
wonderful job as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you, everyone.